The lawyers actually had business there. Others were part of the courthouse crowd that never missed a show. The rumors were that the kid would finally make a public appearance, and this drew them like vultures to a carcass. When Jake emerged from Noose's chambers, he was impressed with the number of people there to witness preliminary hearings that meant little on the road to justice. Josie and Kira were huddled in the front row with Charles and Meg McGarry, and all four looked terrified. Across the aisle, there was a pack of Kofers and friends, all angry. Dumas Lee was sniffing around with another reporter. Judge Noose called the name of Drew Allen Gamble, and Mr. Pete left to find him. They emerged from a side door next to the jury box and paused for a moment to remove the handcuffs. Drew looked around and tried to absorb the enormity of the room and all the people gawking at him. He saw his mother and sister sitting out there, but was too stunned to smile. Mr. Pete led him to a spot in front of the bench where Jake met him, and they looked up at the judge. Jake was 6 feet tall. Mr. Pete was at least 6'1", and both seemed at least a foot taller than their defendant. Noose looked down and said, "You are Drew Allen Gamble." Drew nodded and might have spoken. "Please speak up, sir," Noose almost yelled into his microphone. Jake looked down at his client.
"Yes, sir."
"And you are represented by the Honorable Jake Brigance, right?"
"Yes, sir."
"And you have been indicted by the grand jury of Ford County for the murder of Officer Stuart Kofer, right?" In Jake's biased opinion, Noose was being far too dramatic and playing to the crowd. Hell, the entire first appearance could have been dispensed with a signature.
"Yes, sir."
"And you have a copy of the indictment?"
"Yes, sir."
"And you understand the charges?"
"Yes, sir."
As Noose ruffled some papers, Jake wanted to say something like, "Come on, Judge, how can he not understand the charges? He's been locked up for over a month." He could almost feel the stares drilling into the back of his nice gray blazer, and he knew that this day, May 8th, was the day when he was unofficially crowned the most despised lawyer in town. His Honor asked, "Do you plead guilty or not guilty?"
"Not guilty."
"Okay. You will be remanded to the custody of the Sheriff's Department and await trial for the murder of Stuart Kofer. Anything else, Mr. Brigance?"
"Anything else? Hell, we didn't need this."
"No, sir. Take him away." Josie was trying to control herself. Jake walked back to the defense table and tossed down a useless legal pad. He glanced at Pastor McGarry, then looked directly at the Kofer gang. 2 weeks earlier, Lowell Dyer had informed Jake that he and his investigator would like the opportunity to meet with Josie and Kira and ask questions. It was quite a professional move, because Dyer didn't need Jake's permission to talk to anyone except the defendant. Jake represented Drew, not his family, and if anyone working for law enforcement or the prosecution wanted to chat with a potential witness, they could certainly do so. Unlike civil litigation, where all witnesses were made known and their testimonies probed long before trial, in criminal matters, neither side was required to reveal much of anything. In a simple divorce case, every dollar was accounted for in theory. But in a capital murder trial with a human life on the line, the defense was not entitled to know what the accusing witnesses might say or what opinions the experts might put forth. Jake agreed to arrange a meeting in his office and invited Ozzie and Detective Rady as well. He wanted a crowded room because he wanted both Josie and Kira to experience the tension of discussing what had happened before an audience. Noose adjourned for lunch at 11:30. Jake and Portia walked Josie and Kira across the street and were followed by Dyer and his investigator. They reconvened in the main conference room where Bev had laid out coffee and brownies.
Jake arranged everyone around the table and sat Josie at one end, alone, as if on the witness stand. Lowell Dyer was warm and pleasant and began by thanking her for her time. He had the full report from Detective Rady and knew a lot of her background. She kept her responses brief. The day before, Jake had spent 2 hours coaching her and her daughter at the church. He had even written instructions for them to review, gems such as, "Keep your answers brief. Don't volunteer anything. If you don't know, don't guess. Do not hesitate to ask Mr. Dyer to repeat the question. Say as little as possible about the physical abuse. We'll save it for trial. And most important, always remember that he is the enemy, and he is trying to put Drew on death row." Josie was tough and had been around the block. She got through the questions without emotion and gave only the barest of details about the beatings. Kira was next. For the occasion, and at Jake's request, she wore jeans and a tight blouse. At 14, no one would have suspected that she was 4 months pregnant. Jake had readily agreed to the meeting because he wanted Lowell Dyer to have the opportunity to evaluate the witness before she began showing. On her list of instructions, Portia had typed in bold letters, "Do not mention your pregnancy. Do not mention the rapes. If asked about physical abuse, start crying and don't answer. Jake will intervene." Her voice broke almost immediately, and Dyer didn't push. She was a frightened, fragile child who was now secretly carrying one of her own and seemed thoroughly overwhelmed. Jake grimaced, shrugged, said to Dyer, "Maybe another time." "Sure." Chapter 24. Jake had been careful not to get himself photographed around the courthouse. Evidently, the editor of the Times went to the archives and selected one of 100 from the trial of Carl Lee Haley 5 years earlier. He plastered it on the front page next to one of Drew in handcuffs getting out of the patrol car the day before. Side by side, cop, killer, and lawyer. Each as guilty as the other. Jake poured a cup of coffee in his kitchen and read the report by Dumas Lee. An anonymous source said the trial was scheduled for August 6th in Clanton. The news of the location was interesting. Jake planned to do everything in his power to change venue and have the trial as far away from Clanton as possible. He turned back to the front page. He remembered the photo and had rather liked it back then. The caption under it read, "Defense Attorney Jake Brigance." He was all business, with a proper frown that conveyed the seriousness of the moment. Perhaps he appeared a bit thinner, but he knew he weighed the same. 5 years had passed, and the hairline was still receding. He heard thunder and remembered that rain was in the forecast, another wave of spring storms. He had no appointments for the day, and he had no desire to hang out in the coffee shop. So he said, "Screw it," and went to his bedroom, undressed, and crawled under the covers, where he found the warm body of his wife. Good news continued to pour in. Judge News faxed copies of 2 letters to Jake, 15 minutes apart. The first read, "Dear Judge News, as the attorney for the Ford County Board of Supervisors, I have been asked by the board to respond to your request for attorney's fees for Jake Brigance in the Stuart Cofer matter. As you well know, Section 99-15-17 of the Mississippi Code clearly states that the maximum to be paid by the county for the representation of indigents charged with capital murder is $1,000. There is no language in that statute that gives the board the discretion to pay more. There should be, and we both know that the limit is not sufficient. However, I've discussed this matter with the board, all 5 members, and it is their position that the maximum compensation will be $1,000. I know Jake well, and am happy to discuss this with him. Sincerely, Todd Tannehill, Attorney at Law."
The second letter was from Sean Gilder, attorney for the railroad, and it read, "Dear Judge Noose, it is with a heavy heart that I write to inform you that one of our experts, Dr. Crow Ledford, died suddenly last week, just moments after completing the Key West Marathon. The cause is suspected to be cardiac arrest. Dr. Ledford was a professor at Emory University and an esteemed expert in the field of highway and railroad safety. His testimony was to be the cornerstone of our defense. Though no trial date has been set, we will obviously need additional time to find and hire an expert to replace Dr. Ledford. Our apologies to the court. I will contact Mr. Brigance and tell him this awful news. Sincerely, Sean Gilder." Jake tossed the letter onto his desk and looked at Portia. "A dead expert will buy them another 6 months." She said, "Boss, we need to talk." Jake glanced at his door and said, "It's closed. What's up?"
"Well, I've been working here for almost 2 years."
"And you're ready to become a partner?"
"No, not yet. But I plan to take over after law school."
"You can have it."
"Anyway, I'm worried about this place. I've looked at the phone records for the first 3 months of this year and compared them to the last 6 weeks. Boss, the phone isn't ringing."
"I know that, Portia."
"And worse, the foot traffic has really slowed. On average, we open one new file each day, 5 a week, 20 a month. And we keep about 50 active. In the past 6 weeks, we've opened 7 new files, most for small stuff like shoplifters and no-fault divorces."
"That's my practice."
"Seriously, Jake, I'm worried."
"Thank you, Portia. But I don't want you worrying. That's my job. You learn quick in this business that it's feast or famine."
"When's the feast?"
"We'll get $1,000 for gamble."
"Seriously, Jake."
"I appreciate your concern, but let me handle it. You have your sights set on law school in August, and that's enough to keep you busy." She took a deep breath and tried to smile.
"I think the town has turned against you, Jake."
He paused long enough to acknowledge it, then said, "It's temporary. I'll survive gamble. Then I'll settle Smallwood. A year will pass and everybody will be clamoring for my services. I promise you, Portia, when you finish law school, I'll still be here suing people."
"Thanks."
"Please, go worry about something else." With her mother working sporadic hours at both the feed mill and a chicken processing plant, Kira got bored in the afternoons and hung around the parsonage tending to Justin, the McGarrys' 4-year-old. Meg, now 8 months pregnant, was taking classes at a junior college and appreciated the babysitting. Often, when she was home, they went for long walks down a gravel road behind the church, with Justin ahead of them on his little bike. They liked to stop at a bridge over Carter's Creek and watch him play in the shallow water. Kira adored Meg and talked to her about things her mother wouldn't understand. The abortion had been off limits for some time, but Meg and Charles were watching the calendar and knew the timing was becoming crucial. Kira was midterm and a decision had to be made. Sitting on the edge of the bridge with their feet hanging down, Meg said,
"Does Josie still want you to get an abortion?"
"She says she does. But we can't pay for one."
"What do you want, Kira?"
"I don't want to have a baby, that's for certain. But I really don't want to go through an abortion. Mom says it's not a big deal. Can I tell you a secret?"
"You can tell me anything."
"I know. Mom says she got an abortion one time after Drew and I were born. Says there's nothing to it."
Meg tried to hide her shock that her mother would tell her 14-year-old daughter such a secret.
"That's not true, Kira. Not at all. Having an abortion is a horrible thing to do, and the damage lasts for many years. As Christians, we believe that life begins at conception. The 2 children you and I are carrying right now are living beings, little gifts from God. Having an abortion terminates a life, So you think it's murder?
I do. I know it is.
I don't want to do it.
Is she pressuring you?
All the time. She's afraid she'll get stuck raising another kid. Can she make me get an abortion?
No. Can I tell you a secret?
Sure. That's what we're doing, right?
It is. I talked to Jake off the record and asked him what would happen if Josie took you to a clinic in Memphis and you objected. He said that no clinic, no doctor will perform an abortion if the mother doesn't want it. Don't let her make you do it, Kira.
Kira took her hand and squeezed it. Justin yelled and pointed to a frog at the edge of the water. Meg said,
"You're too young to worry about raising a child, Kira. That's why adoption is the best route. There are plenty of young couples out there who desperately want a child. Charles knows other ministers, and he'll have no problem finding the perfect home for your baby."
"How about a home for us? I'm tired of living in a church."
"We'll find something. And speaking of church, there is another issue we need to chat about, with your mom, too. You're starting to show, and we're trying to keep this a secret, right?"
"That's what Jake said."
"It may be time to stop attending services."
"But I enjoy the services. Everyone is so nice."
"They are. And they like to talk, same as any small church. If they realize you're pregnant, word will spread like crazy."
"What am I supposed to do for the next 4 months? Hide in the church kitchen?"
"Let's discuss it with your mother."
"She'll just say get an abortion."
"That's not happening, Kira. You're going to have a healthy baby and make some young couple very happy."
After Hannah was asleep, Jake went to his car, grabbed a bottle of red wine, uncorked it at the kitchen counter, found two seldom-used wine glasses, stepped into the den, and said to his wife, "Meet me on the patio." Outside, she saw the bottle on the table and asked,
"What's the occasion?"
"Nothing good." He poured two glasses, gave one to her, they clinked, and sat down. "Here's to our pending bankruptcy."
"Cheers, I guess."
Jake took a big gulp. Carla, a much more reasonable sip. He said, "Smallwood just got delayed by months. The county refuses to pay me more than $1,000 for a capital murder defense. The phone has stopped ringing at the office. Josie needs $300 a month to rent a place. And the backbreaker is that Stan at Cabbage called today and his boss wants a payment on our litigation loan."
"How much of a payment?"
"Something like half would make them happy. Half of $70,000. It is, of course, unsecured, and the bank didn't want to make the loan in the first place. Stan says they've never been in the litigation business and are afraid of it. Can't blame them for that."
"I thought they agreed to wait until the case settled."
"Stan did, verbally, but his boss is leaning on him. Remember, they sold out 3 years ago to a bigger bank in Jackson? Stan gets frustrated with some of the decisions down there." Carla took another sip and breathed deeply.
"Okay. I thought Judge Noose had a plan to make sure you got paid."
"He does, but it's a lousy plan. I'm supposed to wait until the trial is over and then sue the county for my time and expenses. He promises to rule in my favor and force the county to pay."
"What's wrong with that?"
"Everything. It means I get nothing for months, nothing to pay the overhead while the practice dries up and the town boycotts me. When I'm forced to sue the county, that'll make the newspaper, so more bad press. And there is really no way Noose can force the county to pay more than $1,000. If the supervisors dig in, and they will, we're screwed." She nodded as if she understood, took another sip, and eventually said,
"Lovely."
"Yes, Noose thinks it's really clever, but then he's desperate for a lawyer to represent the kid."
"Dare I ask how much cash we have right now?"
"Not much. $5,000 in the office account, $8,000 in our money market,
10+ in savings. He slurped some more wine. Pretty pathetic if you think about it. 12 years as a lawyer and only $18,000 socked away.
We have a good life, Jake. We both work. We live better than most. There is equity in the house, right?
A little. We'll have to squeeze out every penny of it to pay Stan.
A second mortgage?
There's no way around it.
What did Harry Rex say?
Well, when he stopped cussing me, we called Stan and they got into it. Harry Rex maintains it's a line of credit with no due date, so the bank will just have to wait. Stan cussed right back and said he would call the entire loan. When I hung up, they were still cussing.
That's unfortunate.
A moment passed as they listened to the crickets. The street was quiet except for the buzz of insects and the distant barking of a dog. Carla asked,
"Did Josie ask for money?"
"No, but she needs to get away from the church. They're tired of living there, and you can't blame them. Kira is midterm and starting to show. She won't be able to hide it much longer. You can imagine how much fun the busybodies will have when they realize she's pregnant."
"And Josie's found a place?"
"She says she's looking, but she's also working part-time jobs now. She can squeeze together $100 a month for rent. Plus, they don't have a stick of furniture."
"So we're paying rent too?"
"Not yet, but I'm sure we'll have to help. And she has a pile of medical bills that she'll have to bankrupt."
"What about medical care for Kira?"
"Oh, that too." After another long pause, Carla said,
"I have a question."
"Okay."
"Did you buy more than one bottle of wine?"
Chapter 25. 3 days after classes ended, and Hannah and Carla were set free for the summer, the Braganzas loaded themselves and the dog into the car and headed for the beach, their annual vacation. Carla's parents had semi-retired to the Wilmington area and owned a spacious condo on the water in Wrightsville Beach. Hannah and Carla loved the sand and the sun. Jake appreciated the rent-free accommodations. Her father, still Mr. McCullough to Jake, liked to refer to himself as an investor and could bore anyone with the latest earnings reports. He also wrote a column for a minor financial magazine that Jake had once, long ago, subscribed to in a vain effort to understand what the guy was up to. His real motive for the subscription had been to figure out if his father-in-law had serious money. So far, Mr. McCullough's net worth was a mystery, but it was obvious he and his wife were quite comfortable. Mrs. McCullough was a pleasant lady in her mid-60s who was active in all manner of garden clubs, turtle savers, and hospital volunteers. The summer before and the summer before that, the Braganzas had flown from Memphis to Raleigh, where they rented a car for the vacation. Hannah wanted to fly again and was disappointed when she first learned of the family road trip. 12 hours of it. She was too young to know of their belt tightening, and her parents were careful with their words and actions. They planned the trip as a grand adventure and mentioned a few sites they might visit along the way. The truth was that they would take turns driving and hoped their daughter would get plenty of sleep. The Saab stayed home. Carla's car was of a more recent vintage and had far fewer miles. Jake bought new tires and got it serviced properly. Off they went at 7 a.m, with Hannah barely awake under the covers in the back seat and cuddled up with the dog. Jake found a 60s station out of Memphis, and he and Carla hummed along with the oldies as the sun rose before them. They had vowed to keep things light, not only for their benefit, but for Hannah's. The law practice was crumbling around them. The bank wanted money. Smallwood, their pot of gold, had become another kind of train wreck. The gamble trial was 2 months away and loomed like its own execution date. As their income fell, their debts climbed and seemed insurmountable. But they were determined to survive. They were not yet 40 years old, in good health, with a lovely home and plenty of friends and a law office that Jake still believed he could build into something bigger. This would be a difficult year financially, but they would get through it and emerge stronger. Hannah announced she was hungry, and Carla challenged her to select the right breakfast place. She chose a fast food restaurant beside the interstate, and they went through the drive-thru. They were making good time, and Jake wanted to arrive before dark. Mrs. McCullough promised to have dinner on the table. They played car games, card games, pick the billboard games, count the cows games, any kind of game Hannah could think of, and they sang along with the radio. When Hannah drifted off, Carla pulled out a paperback, and everything was quiet. Lunch was a burger at another drive-thru, another place selected by Hannah, and before they drove away, they changed drivers. Carla drove for an hour before getting sleepy. Jake wasn't fond of her driving anyway, so they swapped again. Once in the passenger seat, she came to life and couldn't nap. It was almost 2 p.m., and they had hours to go. Carla looked to make sure Hannah was sound asleep and said,
"Okay, I know we're not talking about this, at least in front of her, but I can't get it off my mind."
Jake smiled and said, "Neither can I."
"Good. So here's a big question. A year from now, where will Drew Gamble be?"
A mile passed as he considered this. There are three possible answers, all dictated by what happens at trial. One, he's found guilty of capital murder, which is likely because there's no doubt about what happened, and he's sent to Parchman to await an execution. It might be possible to pull strings and get him placed in some type of protective custody because of his age and size, but it will still be a horrible place. They'll probably place him on the actual death row, where he might be safer because he'll be in solitary confinement.
And his appeals?
They'll go on forever. If he's convicted, I suspect I'll still be writing briefs for him when Hannah's in college. Number two, he's found not guilty by reason of insanity, which is unlikely. If so, he'll probably be put in a treatment facility for an undetermined length of time and eventually released. I'm sure the Gambles will flee the area, and we might be right behind them.
That doesn't really seem fair either. Great for them, terrible for the Kofers. We're caught in the middle.
True.
I don't want the kid to go to prison for the rest of his life, but to walk away after what he did is not fair. There should be something in between, some lesser form of punishment.
I agree. But what is it? Jake asked.
I'm not sure. But I do know something about the insanity defense because of Carl Lee. He wasn't insane, and he got off. Drew seems far more traumatized and detached from reality than Carl Lee.
I agree again. Carl Lee knew exactly what he was doing when he killed those two. He planned it carefully and carried it out perfectly. His defense was not about his mental state. It was about sympathy from the jury. It will all come down to the jury, as always.
And how do you make the jurors sympathetic?
Jake glanced over his shoulder. Hannah and Mully were fast asleep. Softly, he said, "The pregnant sister."
"And the dead mother?"
"The dead mother will be a powerful element and will use it continually. However, she wasn't dead. She was still breathing, with a pulse, and the prosecution will make much of that. The kids should have known that Josie wasn't dead."
"Come on, Jake. Two kids, absolutely terrified, probably hysterical because their mother was unconscious and not responsive, once again beaten by a brute. It seems to me that was quite reasonable to believe she was dead."
"That's what I'll tell the jury."
"Okay. What's the third scenario? A hung jury?"
"Yes. A few of the jurors are sympathetic and refuse to go along with capital murder.
They want something less, but the majority digs in and wants a gas chamber. Deliberations could be a free-for-all as the jury completely deadlocks and hangs itself. After a few days, Noose has no choice but to declare a mistrial and sends everybody home. Drew goes back to his cell and waits for the retrial.
And how likely is that?
You tell me. Put yourself on the jury. You already know the facts. There aren't many of them.
Why do you always put me on the jury?
Jake chuckled. He was guilty again. A hung jury would be a big win. A guilty verdict is more likely. A not guilty by reason of insanity is a long shot. Carla watched the hills pass. They were on an interstate somewhere in Georgia, and she wasn't finished. She turned around again and checked on Hannah, then said softly,
"Josie promised you there will not be an abortion, right?"
She did, reluctantly. Plus, it's too late.
"So there'll be a baby in September, assuming nature cooperates. And Kira seems to be doing well and seeing a doctor."
"Yes, we're paying for some of that."
"And she has agreed to an adoption."
"You were there when she did. Josie is demanding it. She knows who'd end up raising the kid, and right now, she can barely feed Kira and herself." Carla took a deep breath and looked at her husband.
"Have you thought about adopting the child?"
"As a lawyer?"
"No, as a father."
Jake almost gasped, and there was a slight jerk on the wheel. He looked at her in utter amazement, shook his head, and said,
"Well, no. I have not thought about it."
"Obviously, you have."
"Can we talk about it?"
"What don't we talk about?" Both turned to check on Hannah.
"Well,"
Carla said, in that tone that meant that the discussion they were about to have would be complicated. Jake stared straight ahead and ran through his own quick list of complications.
"We talked about adoption years ago, and then for some reason, I can't really remember, we just stopped talking. Hannah was a toddler. The doctors had told us that we were lucky to get pregnant with her after some false starts, and that it would not happen again. We wanted at least one more, maybe two."
"I remember. I was there."
"I guess we just got busy with life and became content with an only child."
"Very content."
"But the baby will need a good home, Jake."
"I'm sure they'll find one. I do several private adoptions a year, and there's always a demand for babies."
"We would have the inside track, Jake, don't you think?"
"I think there are at least two big issues here. Most important, are we as a family ready to expand? Do you, at the age of 37, want another baby?"
"I think so."
"What about Hannah? How will she react?"
"She'll absolutely adore a little brother."
"Brother?"
"Yes. Kira told Meg 2 days ago that it's a boy."
"And why wasn't I informed?"
"It's girl talk, Jake, and you're always too busy. Think about it, Jake. A little boy with a big sister almost 10 years older."
"Why am I suddenly thinking about diapers and walking the floor at night?"
"They outgrow that. The worst part of having a child is giving birth."
"I rather enjoyed it."
"Easy for you to say. Now we can avoid all that."
They were quiet for several miles as both plotted their next moves. Jake was reeling and trying to organize his thoughts. Carla had planned the attack and was prepared for any resistance. He seemed to relax, and then he smiled at his adorable wife. "When exactly did you start thinking about this?"
"I don't know. I've been mulling it over for some time. At first, I thought it was a ridiculous idea, and I thought of all the reasons to let it go. You're the de facto attorney for the family. How would it look for you to use your inside position to get the baby? How would the town react?"
That's the least of my worries.
What type of relationship, if any, would the child have with Kira and Josie? What about the Kofers? I'm sure they'll be horrified when they learn that Stuart left a grandchild behind. I doubt if they'll want anything to do with the child, but you never know. I've thought of a lot of issues and a lot of reasons not to do it. But then I keep thinking about the child. Someone, some lucky couple somewhere, will get the magical phone call. They'll drive to the hospital and leave with a little baby boy. It will be all theirs. Why can't it be us, Jake? We're just as qualified as anyone else.
From the rear seat, a sweet, sleepy little voice said,
"Anybody thinking about a potty break?"
Jake quickly said, "We are now," and began looking at exit signs. They were on the beach at dusk, ambling along in the surf with Hannah splashing and chattering nonstop as she held hands with both grandparents. Jake and Carla held hands too and fell behind, happy at the sight of their little girl being smothered in love. Carla wanted to talk, but Jake was not ready for another discussion about expanding the family.
"I have an idea," she said.
"I'm sure you're about to share it." Ignoring him, she said,
"Drew is sitting in jail every day, falling further behind in his education. He's been there since the end of March with no tutoring. Josie said he's already 2 years behind."
"At least."
"Could you arrange for me to go to the jail 2 or 3 days a week and tutor the kid?"
"Do you have the time?"
"I have the summer, Jake. And I can always find the time. We can ask your mother to keep Hannah. She never says no. And we can also find a babysitter to help."
"Or I can babysit. The way my practice is drying up, I'll have plenty of time."
"Seriously, I can get the textbooks from the school and at least get him on some type of schedule."
"I don't know. Ozzie would have to approve it. And he's not too cooperative these days. Maybe I can ask Judge Noose."
"Would it be safe? I've never been to the jail."
"You're lucky. I'm not sure I like the idea. You'd be close to some rough characters, and you'd be around some cops who are not my best friends these days. Ozzie would have to take some precautions, and he'd probably balk."
"Would you talk to him?"
"Sure, if that's what you want."
"No chance he could leave the jail for a few hours each week to meet somewhere else?"
"Not a chance." Hannah and her grandparents had turned around and were getting close. Mrs. McCullough said,
"How about a glass of wine while I get dinner ready?"
"Sounds delightful," Jake said. "We've eaten 2 meals in the car today, and I'm ready for some real food." Chapter 26. After 5 days of walking the beach, swimming, reading, sleeping late, and napping, and getting slaughtered in chess by Mr. McCullough, Jake was ready for a break. Early on the morning of May 31st, he hugged Carla, said goodbye to his in-laws, and happily drove away, eager to spend the next 5 hours in blissful solitude. The Kids Advocacy Foundation had an office on M Street near Farragut Square in central Washington. The building was a 1970s-style block of gray brick with 5 floors and far too few windows. The directory in the lobby listed the names of dozens of associations, nonprofits, coalitions, federations, brotherhoods, and so on. Everything from American Raisin Growers to the Disabled Rural Mail Carriers. Jake got off the elevator on the 4th floor and found the right door. He stepped inside to a cramped reception room where a small, dapper gentleman of about 70 sat behind a neat desk and greeted him with a smile.
"You must be Mr. Brigance, all the way from Mississippi."
"I am, yes," Jake said, stepping forward with an outstretched hand.
"I'm Roswell, the boss around here," he said, standing.
He wore a tiny red bow tie and a crisp white shirt.
"A pleasure to meet you."
They shook hands. Jake, in khakis and a button-down, no tie, no socks, said, "And nice to meet you."
"You drove up from the beach, right?" Yes. Jake glanced around and took in the decor. The walls were covered with framed portraits of young people in prison whites and jail coveralls, some looking out from behind bars, others in handcuffs. "Welcome to our headquarters," Roswell said with another cheerful smile. "That's quite a case you have down there. I've read your summaries. Libby expects us to read everything." He waved at a door as he spoke. "She's waiting." Jake followed him into a hallway, and they stopped at the first door. Roswell said, "Libby, Mr. Brigance is here. Mr. Brigance, meet the real boss, Libby Provine." Ms. Provine was waiting in front of her desk and quickly offered a hand.
"A pleasure, Mr. Brigance. Mind if I call you Jake? We're quite informal around here."
The accent was thick Scottish. The first time they had spoken on the phone, Jake struggled to handle the brogue. "Jake's fine. Nice to meet you." Roswell disappeared, and she pointed to a small conference table in the corner of her office.
"I thought you might want some lunch."
On the table were two deli sandwiches on paper plates and bottles of water.
"Lunch is served," she said.
They took their places at the table, but neither made a move for the food.
"An easy drive?" she asked.
"Uneventful. I was happy to get away from the beach and the in-laws." Libby Provine was about 50, with red curly hair that was graying, and she wore sleek designer frames that made her almost attractive. From his research, he knew she had founded the nonprofit 20 years earlier, not long after she finished law school at Georgetown. KAF, as it was known, had a staff of paralegals and four lawyers, all in-house. Its mission was to assist in the defense of teenagers on trial for serious crimes, and more specifically, to try and rescue them during the sentencing phase after they had been convicted. After a few minutes of chit-chat, with neither reaching for the sandwiches, though Jake was starving, Libby asked,
"And you expect the state to proceed with capital murder?"
"Oh, yes. We have a hearing in 2 weeks on the issue, but I do not expect to win. The state is going full speed ahead."
"Even though Kofler was not actually on duty?"
"That's the issue. As you know, the statute was changed 2 years ago, and the new one is hard to ignore."
"I know. Such a needless change of law. What's it called? The Death Penalty Enhancement Act? As if the state needed more muscle in its quest to fill up death row. Total rubbish."
She knew everything. Jake had spoken to her twice on the phone and sent a 40-page review that he and Portia had put together. He had talked to two other lawyers, one in Georgia, one in Texas, who had relied on KAF at trial, and their opinions were glowing.
She said, "Only Mississippi and Texas allow the death penalty for the killing of an officer, regardless of whether he was on duty. It makes no sense."
"We're still fighting the war down there. I'm starving.
Chicken salad or turkey and Swiss?"
"I'll take the chicken salad." They unwrapped the sandwiches and took a bite, hers much smaller than his. She said,
"We dug up some newspaper reports about the Haley trial. Sounds like a real shoo."
"You could call it that.
Looks like the insanity defense worked for a man who wasn't insane."
"It was all about race, something that will not be a factor with Gamble."
"And your expert, Dr. Bass?"
"I wouldn't dare use him again. He's a drunk and a liar, and I used him only because he was free. We got lucky. Have you found us the right expert?" She nibbled on the crust of her sandwich and nodded.
"You'll need at least two experts, one for the insanity defense, which I believe is all you have, and one for sentencing, assuming he's convicted. That's where we can help. Virtually all of our clients are guilty, and some of their crimes are pretty horrific. We just try to keep them alive and out of prison for the rest of their lives."
Jake had a mouthful, so he just nodded. Libby, apparently, was a light eater. She continued,
"One day in this great land, the Supreme Court will rule that sending juveniles to death row is cruel and unusual punishment. But we're not there yet. The court may also see the light and rule that sentencing kids to prison for life without parole is nothing but a death sentence. Again,
we're not there yet. So we soldier on.
She finally took another bite. Jake had asked for money and manpower, money for expert testimony and litigation expenses, and he wanted the assistance of another seasoned lawyer in the second chair during the trial. The law required a second defense lawyer, but Noose was having trouble finding one. Jake had made these requests in writing, and they had discussed them over the phone. KAF lawyers were overworked. Its funds were tight. He had driven 5 hours for the meeting to say hello and impress upon Libby Provine the urgency of Drew's case. Perhaps a face-to-face meeting would lead to her cooperation. Two other requests to similar organizations were pending, but did not look promising. She said,
"We've used a child psychiatrist from Michigan in a number of cases, a Dr. Emil Jambla. He's the best so far. A Syrian, slightly darker skin, speaks with an accent. Might this be a problem down there?"
Oh, yes. Could be a real problem. Anybody else?
"Our second choice would be a doctor out of New York."
"Got anybody with the right accent?"
"Maybe. There's one who's on the faculty at Baylor."
"Now you're talking. You know how experts work in courtrooms, Libby. He or she needs to be from another state because the farther he or she has traveled to get there, the smarter he or she is perceived to be by the jury. On the other hand, people down there react strongly to strange accents, especially northern ones."
"I know. I tried a case in Alabama 10 years ago. Can you imagine me talking to a jury in Tuscaloosa? It was not a good outcome. The kid was 17. Now he's 27 and still on death row."
"I think I read that case."
"What will your jury look like?"
"Frightening. A regular posse. It's rural North Mississippi, and I'll try to change venue to another county simply because of the notoriety. But wherever we go, the demographics are much the same. 75% white, average household income of $30,000. I expect 9 or 10 whites, 2 or 3 blacks, 7 women, 5 men, ages 30 to 60, all Christians or claiming to be. Of the 12, maybe 4 made it to college. 4 didn't finish high school. 1 person earning $50,000 a year. 2 or 3 unemployed. God-fearing souls who believe in law and order."
"I've seen that jury. Is the trial still set for August the 6th?
"It is, and I don't see a delay."
"Why so soon?"
"Why not? And I have a good reason for warning the trial on August 6th. I'll explain in a moment."
"Okay. How do you see it unfolding?"
"Fairly cut and dried, to a point. The state will go first, of course. The prosecutor is competent, but inexperienced. He'll begin with the investigators, crime scene photos, cause of death, autopsy, and so on. The facts are plain, unambiguous. The photos are horrendous. So he'll have the jury in his pocket at the opening bell. The victim was an Army veteran, a fine peace officer, a local boy, all that. The case is really not that complicated. Within minutes, the jury will know the victim and his killer and see the murder weapon. During cross-examination, I'll ask about the autopsy and drag out the truth that at the time of his death, Mr. Kofor was blind drunk. That will begin the ugly process of putting him on trial, and it'll get worse. Some of the jurors will resent this. Others will be shocked. At some point, the state will probably call the sister, Kira, to the stand. She is an important witness, and she'll be expected to say that she heard the gunshot and her brother admitted to killing Kofor. The DA will attempt to prove that his actions and movements before the shooting show that the kid knew what he was doing. It was revenge. He thought his mother was dead, and he wanted revenge.
Sounds believable.
Indeed it does. But Kira's testimony could be even more dramatic. When she takes the stand, the jury and everybody else in the courtroom will know immediately that she is pregnant, over 7 months along. And guess who the father is?
Not Kofor.
Yes. I'll ask her to identify the father, and she'll testify, rather emotionally, I suspect,
that he was raping her on a regular basis, 5 or 6 times, beginning around Christmas. Whenever they were alone, he raped her. And after each assault, he threatened to kill her and her brother if she told anyone. Libby was speechless. She shoved her sandwich a few inches away and closed her eyes. After a moment, she asked,
"Why would the state put her on the stand if she's pregnant?"
"Because the state doesn't know it." She took a deep breath, moved her chair back, stood and walked to the other end of her office. From behind her desk, she asked,
"Don't you have an obligation to inform the prosecutor?"
"No, she's not my witness. She's not my client."
"I'm sorry, Jake, but I'm having some trouble processing this. Are you trying to hide the fact that she's pregnant?"
"Let's just say I don't want the other side to know it."
"But won't the DA and its investigators meet with their witnesses before trial?"
"Normally, yes. It's up to them. They can meet with her whenever they want. They talked to her 2 weeks ago in my office."
"Is the girl in hiding? Does she have friends?"
"Not many, and yes, she's basically in hiding. I explained to Kira and Josie that it would be best if no one knows she's pregnant. But there's always the chance that she'll be discovered. There's also the chance that the DA will find out. But she's going to testify at trial, either for the prosecution or the defense. And if the trial's in August, she'll be 7 months pregnant."
"Is she showing?"
"Barely. Her mother has told her to wear nothing but oversized clothing. They're still living in the church, but I'm trying to find them a place, an apartment in another town. They stopped attending church services a couple of weeks ago and are trying to avoid everyone."
"At your recommendation, I'm sure."
Jake smiled and nodded. Libby paced back to the table and sat down. She drank from her bottle and said,
"Wow.
I thought you'd like it. A defense lawyer's dream. A total ambush of the prosecution's witness.
I know discovery is limited down there, but this seems a bit extreme."
"As I said in my memo, there is virtually no discovery in criminal cases. Same for most of the country." She knew this. She took a bite of her sandwich and chewed slowly, her mind racing.
"What about a mistrial? Surely the state will scream about the surprise and want a new trial."
"The state rarely gets a mistrial. We've gone back 80 years and researched hundreds of cases involving mistrials. Only 3 were granted to the prosecution, and all involved important witnesses who didn't show up for court. And I'll argue that a mistrial is unnecessary because the girl would testify at trial regardless of which side calls her as a witness."
"Any chance Kofler is not the father?"
"Doubtful. She's 14 and swears he was the first and only." Libby shook her head and looked away. When she looked back, Jake noticed moisture in her eyes.
"She's just a baby,"
she said softly. "A sweet girl who's had a tough life."
"You know, Jake, these are terrible trials. I've been through dozens of them in many states. Kids who commit murder are not like adults who commit murder. Their brains have not fully formed. They are easily influenced. They are often abused and mistreated and cannot escape bad environments. Yet, they're able to pull the trigger, same as an adult. And the victims are just as dead. Their survivors are just as angry. This is your first, right?"
"Yes, and I didn't ask for it."
"I know. As bad as these trials are, this is my work, my calling, and I'm still challenged by it. I love the courtroom, Jake, and I really don't want to miss the moment when Kira takes the stand. Talk about drama of the highest order."
"Does this mean?"
"I want to be there. I have a trial in Kentucky in early August, but we'll push for a continuance. Our other lawyers are booked. Maybe, just maybe, I can clear my schedule and step in."
"That would help considerably." Jake could not suppress a smile. "What about the money?"
"We're broke, same as always. We'll cover my time and expenses, and we'll provide the expert if and when we get to the sentencing. I'm afraid you're on your own to hire the right insanity person."
Any ideas?
Well, sure, she said. I know plenty of them. White, black, brown, male, female, young or old. Take your pick. I'll find the right one. Just let me think about it.
Definitely white. Probably female, don't you think? Our best chance for a little mercy might come from women. Someone who's been slapped around by a drunk. Someone carrying a dark secret about being sexually assaulted. Someone with a teenage daughter.
We keep a thick file on the best experts.
Don't forget about the accent.
Of course not. In fact, there's a shrink in New Orleans we used about 3 years ago. I wasn't in the courtroom, but our lawyers were impressed. So was the jury.
How much might this expert cost me?
$20,000, give or take.
I don't have $20,000.
I'll see what I can do.
Jake offered a hand to shake and said, Welcome to Ford County, though let's hope the trial is somewhere else. She shook his hand and said,
Deal.
Chapter 27. The investigator for the district attorney was a former Tyler County deputy named Jerry Snook. On a Monday morning, he arrived for work at the DA's office in the courthouse in Gretna and began planning his week. 15 minutes later, he was summoned to Lowell Dyer's office next door. His boss was already in a foul mood. Dyer said,
Just got off the phone with Earl Cofer, who calls me at least 3 times a week. Wanted to know what he always wants to know. When's the trial? I said, August the 6th, same as the last time you called. The date is set and will not be moved. Wanted to know if the trial will be in Ford County. I said, I don't know because Brigance wants to move it. Why, he asked. Because he thinks there's too much notoriety around Clanton and is looking for a friendlier venue. He wants a jury that's not familiar with the case. This upset Earl, and he started cussing, said the system is always rigged to protect the criminal. I explained that we will resist any effort to move the case, but the decision will be left to Judge Noose. He ranted about Brigance and the Carl Lee Haley trial and said the system wasn't fair because he got off by claiming to be insane, and that's what Brigance will do again. I reminded him that Judge Noose refused to change venue in that trial, and it's been a long time since he agreed to move one. I explained that it's rare in Mississippi for a judge to change venue and so on. But he doesn't listen and is really bitter, which I understand. He wants me to guarantee that the kid will be convicted and sent to death row. And he wanted to know when there will be an execution. He said he read somewhere that Mississippi has plenty of men on death row, but can't seem to get them to the gas chamber. Said the average time on death row is 18 years. Said he can't wait that long, that his family is devastated, and on, the same conversation we had last Friday. Sorry, boss, Snook said.
Dyer moved some papers around on his desk.
Oh, well, just part of the job, I guess. You wanted to talk about the mother and sister.
Yes, primarily the sister. We need to talk to them now. We have a general idea of what Josie will say at trial, but we will not call her as a witness. The girl, though, has to testify. We have to assume that the defendant will not take the stand, so we have to call his sister. What do you know about them as of today?
They're still living in the church. Josie is working at least 2 part-time jobs. Don't know what the girl is doing. She's a kid and school's out.
We can't talk to her unless her mother is present. I mean, we could, in theory, but it would cause problems. Brigance would get involved and raise hell. It looks like they're doing whatever he says.
I don't mind knocking on the door when Josie's gone.
Dyer was shaking his head. She'll freak out and call her mother. It's too risky. I'll call Brigance and arrange a meeting.
Good luck with that.
The trial's in 2 months. Are you ready? I will be. When are you headed to Ford County?
Tomorrow.
Stop by and say hello to Earl Kofa. The family needs to be reassured.
Would love to.
Jake and Carla parked in front of the jail and walked in the front door. He had his briefcase. She was carrying a large cloth bag filled with textbooks and notepads. Inside, Jake spoke to two deputies he knew, but did not introduce his wife. The mood was immediately tense, and the greetings were strained. He led Carla through a door to the jail and stopped at the counter where Sergeant Buford was waiting on them. Jake said,
"Ozzie told us to be here at 9. Judge Noose's orders."
Buford glanced at his watch as if Jake couldn't tell time.
"I need to look at that," he said, pointing to Jake's briefcase.
Jake opened it for a quick inspection. Satisfied but not pleased with the encounter, Buford looked at Carla's bag and asked,
"What's in there?"
She opened it and said,
"Textbooks and notepads."
He poked around without removing anything and growled,
"Follow me."
Though Jake had reassured her, Carla's stomach was in knots. She had never been inside the jail and half expected to see real criminals leering at her through the bars. But there were no cells, only a dank, narrow hallway with worn carpet and doors on both sides. They stopped at one, and Buford unlocked it with one of the many keys on his ring.
"Ozzie said 2 hours. I'll be back at 11.
"I'd like to leave in an hour," Jake said.
Buford shrugged, as if he could not care less, and opened the door. With a jerk of the head, he motioned for them to step inside and then locked the door behind them. Drew was sitting at a small table in the same faded coveralls he wore every day. He did not stand or say hello. His hands were free, and he'd been playing with a deck of cards. Jake said,
"Drew, this is my wife, Miss Brigance, but you can call her Miss Carla."
Drew smiled, because it was impossible not to smile at Carla. They sat in metal chairs across the narrow table. Carla smiled and said,
"Nice to meet you, Drew."
Jake said, "Now, Drew, as I explained yesterday, Miss Carla will visit you twice a week and organize a plan for your schoolwork."
"Okay."
Carla said,
"Jake tells me you were in the 9th grade last year, right?"
"Uh-huh."
With a smile, Jake said,
"Drew, I want you to get in the habit of saying yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am. Yes, sir, and no, sir would be a good thing, too. Can you practice this?"
"Yes, sir."
"Attaboy."
Carla said,
"I checked with your teachers, and they told me your subjects were Mississippi History, Algebra 1, English, and General Science. Does that sound right?"
"I guess so."
"Do you have a favorite subject?"
"Not really. I didn't like any of them. I hate school."
The teachers had verified this. They were unanimous in their assessment that he was indifferent to his studies, barely made passing grades, had few friends, kept to himself, and in general seemed miserable at school. Carla's first impression was similar to Jake's. It was difficult to believe that the kid was 16 years old. 13 would have been a good guess. He was frail, skinny, with a mop of blonde hair that badly needed trimming. He was awkward, timid, and avoided eye contact. The thought that he had committed such a heinous murder was hard to fathom. She said,
"Okay, a lot of kids hate school, but you can't drop out. Let's just say that this is not school. Let's call it private tutoring. What I want to do is take about 30 minutes with each subject and then leave you with some homework."
"Homework sounds like school," Drew said,
and they laughed. For Jake, it was a minor breakthrough, the first attempt at humor he had seen by his client.
"I guess it does. Where would you like to start?"
He shrugged and said,
"I don't care. You're the teacher."
"Okay. Let's start with math."
Drew frowned and Jake mumbled,
"Not my favorite either."
Carla reached into her bag, pulled out a notebook, and placed it on the table. She opened it and removed a single sheet of paper.
"Here are 10 basic math problems I want you to do for me.
She handed him a pencil. The problems were simple sums that any fifth grader could handle in a matter of minutes. To ease the pressure, Jake removed a file from his briefcase and was soon lost in something lawyerly. Carla pulled out a history textbook and thumbed through it. Drew went to work and did not appear to struggle. His academic progress had been uneven, to say the least. In his young life, he had attended at least 7 schools in different districts and states. He had dropped out at least twice and transferred numerous times. He had lived in 3 foster homes, 1 orphanage, with 2 relatives, in a borrowed camper, spent 4 months in a juvenile jail for stealing bikes, and there had been stretches of homelessness in which there had been no school at all. His most stable period had been from the ages of 11 to 13, when his mother was in prison and he and Kira were sent to a Baptist orphanage in Arkansas, where they found structure and security. Once paroled, Josie reclaimed her children, and the family continued its chaotic journey to somewhere. With Josie's written consent, Portia had doggedly tracked down his school records and Kira's as well, and put together their sad little biographies. Jake, while pretending to read with a frown, was thinking of how far his client had come in the past 11 weeks. From his catatonic state in their first meetings, through his first words, his 2 weeks at Whitfield, his forced acceptance of solitary confinement, and the dreariness of life in a cell,